Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes, joined by Carrie Cordero, who's a senior fellow at the Center for New American Security. Did I get that title right?
Yes.
Or almost right. Yeah. CNN contributor, analyst for CNN, and a contributing editor for the Lawfare blog. Well, we have a lot of ground to cover here. So you do you have kids in college, by the way?
No.
Okay. I'm trying to get my head around this whole the scandal involving all of the admissions and how truly awful it is, and you know, people talking about the entitled super rich and the way they want to game the system. You know, the irony is that the people who are engaging in the fraud are not the super rich; they're just sort of the sort of rich, because the super rich do the same thing but out in the open. I mean, they just endow a building, right? I mean, they just, if you give, in America today, if you write out a check for $25 million for a building and then your kid gets admitted to, say, Harvard, that's considered philanthropy, right? But, you know, you pay off the swim coach for 250 measly $1,000 and you go to jail. See, life is not fair, is it?
Well, you know, I'm a parent and I do think that probably the saddest part of this whole thing is the fact that these parents just had so little confidence or faith in their own kids to think that unless they grease the skids for them to be able to mm-hmm. get into the school of the parents' choice, that somehow they wouldn't be successful in life, whether or not they could have gone to another school, whether or not they would choose another path of doing something else or finding their own way. It's just a sad commentary on their faith in their kids and in their own abilities.
Let's talk about what's going on in Washington, because it's sort of the good news, bad news scenario where the president is President Trump is at the end of all of this is going to get his emergency declaration. He's going to get his emergency declaration until and unless it's thrown out by the courts. But there was a jailbreak in the United States Senate with enough Republicans breaking with the president to vote to overturn that emergency declaration. So first of all, let's just talk about the substance of the issue, because you know there's a lot of people who are defending the president, saying, look, this is nothing like what Barack Obama did. He has statutory authority. He's actually doing something that is well within the law. Do you agree with that?
Well, so let's lay it out. So the president invoked the National Emergencies Act, which is part of the law. Many national emergencies have been designated by presidents over time. Congress has not asserted itself in the past to terminate those emergencies as it could. And so there has been a pretty substantial precedent set for presidents being able to use that authority. What's different here is that the president used it for a situation that, by all objective measures, is not a crisis situation or is not a national emergency. And we know that from a few ways. First of all, the administration never really, before his proclamation establishing the emergency was issued, they never laid out factual narratives mm-hmm. or intelligence assessments that the public could look at and that members of Congress could look at to actually understand what the emergency situation was or is. Second, too much time elapsed from the time that the president said that he wanted to perhaps use his emergency authorities from the to the time that he actually issued the proclamation. The issues on the border with respect to immigration and challenges on the border and drug trafficking, those are not new issues. Those are issues and problems and challenges that have been around for years. And so the president did not articulate what the urgent situation was over the last several months. I was involved in all sorts of national security related legislative issues in the 2000s when we were working so strongly on counterterrorism-related issues. And in those cases, when the executive branch was requesting new legal authorities, for example, for surveillance, the heads of intelligence components and senior Justice Department leaders and the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General, they would go up to Congress and they would brief Congress on here's what the factual situation is underlying the need for these important legal authorities. That didn't happen prior to the president's proclamation. That type of work wasn't done. And it's because there wasn't actually, as far as we know, these types of considered intelligence assessments created to establish the record. So instead, Congress actually did act. It had time to act. It decided not to give him the amount of money that he wanted for the wall. Emergency authority is supposed to be used when there's not time for Congress to act. And a benchmark that I'll give you is it took Congress, I think, about 45 days to pass the USA Patriot Act in October of 2001 after 9/11, which was a suite of authorities intended to assist in counterterrorism activities. 45 days. By the time the president issued his proclamation on the border in February of 2019, it had been long past 45 days since he had been first mentioning that he might use the authority back in December. And then Congress did actually act. So this this vote that the Senate has had is an important step for them to call out the president and establish that emergencies have to be actual emergencies. And if Congress has acted and spoken on how they want money to be used, the president can't use national emergency authorities to go around it.
So your analysis is basically saying that no, he does not have – you would challenge him on statutory grounds. A lot of the senators seem to be looking at this from also the Article One perspective, the separation of powers, the Congress's power of the purse, the usurpation of that by this particular action. So is that more of a political question than a question that the courts will be dealing with?
Well, the statutory issue has to do with some of the specific sections that – they invoked, for example, using reorienting Department of Defense money and using the Army in order to – using the military, excuse me, using the Defense Department to build or reprogram funds to be able to build the wall. The constitutional argument does have to do with the fact that Congress did act and passed legislation that was simply not the amount of money that the president wanted. And so his invocation of the national emergencies was really to go around Congress's expressed path forward.
So what do you think, going ahead with legal challenges in the courts, what is the administration's greatest point of vulnerability?
Even though Congress is not going to get to a veto-proof majority on terminating the president's national emergency, there still are going to be lawsuits that are continuing to challenge his use of it. And we'll see as they work their way through whether or not the statutory arguments that are specific to the rerouting and use of the Department of Defense turn out to be the issue that the courts are most interested in.
My sense, and of course, I am not a lawyer and I don't even play one on podcasts, that the courts in the past have been very deferential to the executive on questions like this, on questions of what constitutes an emergency. That appears to be what Donald Trump is counting on, that this is going to get to the U.S. Supreme Court and that the majority of the court is just simply going to defer to the executive's discretion there.
Well, as a national security lawyer, this is a fundamental question.
Yeah.
So national security lawyers in the government certainly argue that the president has the authority to determine what is an actual national security threat, and courts generally do not look behind that. They don't right. get to second guess what the executive says is a national security threat. That's why what the president has done in my view, is so damaging to the presidency. He's weakening the actual institution of the presidency because he is using its authorities in a way that, as the courts push back on it and as the Congress pushes back on it, will weaken future presidents' ability to continue to have strong national security authority. So it is unlikely that the courts will look behind his designation of the emergency, because they won't want to look behind whether or not there actually is a factual basis. We saw this a little bit with the travel ban as well. Courts are generally, as you said, deferential to the executive. But I think because he's using that authority so recklessly and without any established basis, that there is a possibility that courts will simply look at it and say, we don't see the threat that is being described. And if courts start to go down that path, then we are going to be left with a weaker executive as a result of this person being in office.
But maybe that's a good thing in terms of righting the imbalance that's been created with executive power. Maybe this is the moment for people to, you know, for the system to rebalance itself, that too much authority has been vested in the executive, too much unchecked authority, and perhaps a more restrained executive who would have to reserve the emergency declarations for genuine emergencies would not be the worst possible outcome and really doesn't endanger national security.
Well, it could be an outcome, and some may think that recalibration is a good thing, and it may be that that's what the country is going to go through over the next several years. It won't just be with respect to national security authorities, though, or emergency authorities. It'll be with respect to the pardon power. It'll be with respect to the executive's ability to terminate treaties. It's going to be against a whole host of authorities, and from a national security perspective, the risk of that, it may be that that's a good thing, and there is a strong argument that recalibration is needed. The other side of that, though, is that when there is a true emergency, will a future executive be as well positioned to address it as they have been in the past?
Let's talk about the Mueller investigation and where we are at right here. I don't want to get into the weeds of Manafort or Roger Stone too much. The more indications in the last 24 hours that the Mueller investigation might be winding down. We've heard that about 100 times before. But do I have the name right? Andrew Weissman leaving would certainly be an indication that maybe they are getting closer to the end. You have any sense of this?
Yeah, I do. I saw NPR's reporting, Carrie Johnson's reporting, and some other reporting that Andrew Weissman's leaving. I do think that that probably is a significant milestone in terms of him leaving the
Why?
Team.
What was his role?
He was one of the lead prosecutors working directly for Special Counsel Mueller. He had served previously as FBI Director Mueller's general counsel at one point. So he's been a very close advisor over different positions at different points in each of their careers and tenure in government. So I think he is a significant departure, and it does indicate that at least one big portion of the investigation is wrapping up.
You know, this is one of the hardest things, I think, for some of us to talk about, because we simply do not know what Mueller is going to come up with. Are you expecting more indictments? Are we now at the report phase, that he's simply able to report to report to the DOJ, which in some redacted form will be sent to Congress? And do you have any expectations of what he might tell the DOJ and Congress?
So to take the indictments question first, I think there is a big question whether or not there are going to be more indictments between today and whenever this investigation is concluded. One report or one analysis that I read, I think it was Garrett Graff's piece in Wired, indicated that there may be some sealed indictments that still are in place. And so it's really just a big question mark that I have as to whether or not there's
a piece of this investigation that has been under seal that will reveal more indictments, and then I would expect that those would be indictments perhaps of Americans more tied closely to involvement in the conspiracy to conduct the hacks. And then the other big question mark investigatively for me is the role of WikiLeaks and what is that case in the Eastern District of Virginia that was inadvertently revealed. So I think that's a big question mark as to whether or not there are more indictments to come. With respect to the report, you know, we've seen all sorts of observers have different theories about what the report might be. I have tended to assess that it will be in the form of a prosecutive memo that lays out, in terms of a memo that would go from the special counsel to the attorney general, that would lay out, here's all the different potential violations that we looked at. Here's all the facts that underlie them. Here's the investigation that we did, and here's the charges that we brought. Here's the potential criminal violations that we looked at that we decided we could not charge, and we could either not charge those because there were not sufficient facts establishing that we could have a reasonable success on the merits, a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits, which is it's sort of a general standard for determining whether to take a prosecution forward, or we did not indict because perhaps the subject, perhaps as it relates maybe to obstruction, is the President of the United States, and because of the existing Justice Department policy, we're not going to do that. And then that prosecutive memo would be delivered to the Attorney General, and then the Attorney General decides what of that is going to be in his report to Congress. And I do not expect that the Attorney General will want to reveal information that falls into the declination category. In other words, here's things that the team investigated that did not rise to the level of prosecution, unless in his judgment it's information that should be provided to Congress because it would support or be relevant to Congress's investigation into rule of law or potential impeachment charges.
Yeah, now that's obviously a big asterisk there, because if in fact the position of the Department of Justice is that the sitting president cannot be indicted, that the only way that the system can deal with him is through the impeachment process or congressional oversight, then they have to, right?
They do. By the way, is not a constitutional crisis. Yeah. I keep hearing, you know, different observers or current or former politicians say that this is a constitutional crisis. It is not. If this process goes forward, the special counsel regulations were created after Congress decided not to renew the independent counsel statute. So that was a deliberate choice. The special counsel regulations were created. It has functioned as designed, as far as we know so far, with appropriate oversight from the Attorney General or previously the acting Attorney General. We'll see how the report goes forward. And if there ends up being some kind of referral like that, that is not a constitutional crisis. That's as the Constitution was designed.
The House of Representatives voted unanimously to pass a non-binding resolution urging the Department of Justice to release the Mueller report, or as much of it as they possibly could have. We talked about this on the podcast yesterday. I have a hard time taking that really seriously, because sometimes unanimity indicates that it's completely toothless, which in fact this is. But does that have any influence, or is that just eyewash?
Well,
I used a much harsher word yesterday, but I'm being nice today.
I think it's fine in that it shows that members of Congress are at least unanimous, or in the House, that they are unanimous in their belief that there should be fulsome reporting of what happened. And so I think that agreement is not necessarily a bad thing, especially when there is often so little that they can agree on. At the same time, I do think that this particular resolution is probably pretty consistent with what now Attorney General, then nominee Barr said in his hearings, which is that he'll release as much as he can consistent with Department of Justice policy and practice. So so I don't necessarily think that it goes beyond what he has already committed to do.
Now, I start off by saying that we have no idea what's going to be in the Mueller report, but there's another school of thought that says actually we do, that it's all been laid out over time, that unlike most investigations, a lot of the stuff has been exposed, it has been discussed in real time, that you can connect the dots between the campaign and Russia. The obstruction of justice has been done in broad daylight. Therefore, while in most circumstances this stuff would be exposed to daylight by the release of the report, we actually do know most of what Mueller has found. Where do you come down on that?
I think we know a lot as it relates to Russian influence activities, Russian government influence activities in the 2016 election. So the indictment of the Internet Research Agency and various Russian individuals who were involved in that did provide a lot of information in those charging documents regarding what they were actually doing, which involved not only activities like the hacking into the DNC or the attempted intrusions into the Clinton campaign emails and things like that, but the social media campaign, the disinformation campaign, and the real world outreach that they did to individuals in the United States to try to sow dissent. So I think that narrative is pretty well explained in the charging documents that have that the special counsel's office provided. On obstruction, I don't think that the public record is as clear because there have not been charging documents, obviously, and amongst lawyers and legal commentators, there is probably some disagreement as to whether the activities of the president, which have been quite out in the open, at least some of the ones that we know about, whether or not that rises to the level of an obstruction case. I certainly think that there's been a pattern of obstruction established through just the activities that we know about publicly, but that hasn't been laid out by a prosecutor.
Yeah, that's what's so interesting. I'm actually wrestling with coming up with a how to describe this. You know, was it Michael Kinsley once famously defined the Washington gaffe as saying something, you know, that's true just sort of out loud, and that becomes kind of a scandal. There's a different kind of scandal, which is one that it's happening right in front of you. There it is. The fact that he is tweeting it rather than meeting in a dark alley and doing it doesn't really change the substance of this. Quick question about Manafort, and there's a lot of this, but I don't understand. Your thoughts about what happened this week when he, you know, was sentenced for the second time in Virginia, relatively modest sentences, and that same day, the prosecutors in New York announced 16 indictments against him, which, of course, is being touted as, well, these are charges that Trump cannot use his pardon authority to wipe away. So any thoughts about New York's very aggressive stance on this and how the federal charges and the state charges might interplay?
Well, first of all, whether or not any of these state charges would be in conflict, or whether there would be a double jeopardy issue, as some have described, with respect to the charges, really depends on the details of the specific facts that were involved in charging the mortgage fraud, as I understand it, that they've done out of the New York DA's office. So whether or not it's a viable case, I don't think I'm in a position yet to say. And it should not be taken as a sure thing that actually is a viable case. I mean, you'd really have to go through and compare the underlying conduct that they are charging and how it relates to the underlying conduct that was the subject of his federal convictions. That said, I do have a worry that with respect to the activities of the New York DA, and also the civil inquiry that appears to have been started by the New York Attorney General, that there is a concern that these prosecutions can be viewed by the public as politically motivated. And that is exactly the opposite of what is good for the justice system right now. You know, we have a president who constantly has expressed his intent and his desire to be able to use the justice system and the federal justice department as a tool of his political retribution. And that is a bad thing. And so many of us who are able to speak publicly, who are former Justice Department lawyers, feel so strongly that the Justice Department needs to be protected as an institution, that the independent judgment of prosecutors insulated from political influence is such an important foundation. I worry that the timing of these announcements this week, because it looks like their goal is just to make sure that Mr. Manafort stays in jail. And that's not really the goal, should not be the goal of the justice system. He was charged with federal crimes. He pleaded guilty to some of them. He was convicted by a jury of others, and he was sentenced by two federal judges. So if these state and local officials really have legitimate cases that they need to bring forward, then that's their responsibility. But I do hope that these state and local officials are mindful of the potential way that these can be viewed as overtly political.
Well, this, of course, is the danger of this mutual escalation. You're doing this, so therefore that justifies us using these particular tactics. You know, and you do mention the need for the Justice Department to be protected against all this. I think one of the shocks to the system, or at least shocks to observers, is the recognition, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, is that the president legally can call in the Attorney General into the Oval Office and tell him, I want you to launch an investigation against Kerry Cordero and Charlie Sykes. I want you to open a docket. I want you to open a grand jury on them. And that if the Attorney General goes around and does that, that is actually legal. It violates every possible norm and perhaps is impeachable, but that there, you know, besides that sort of honor system norm, we really don't have any protections built in.
Yeah, but Charlie, I would characterize that as an abuse of executive authority. This is a debate that that I think conservatives are having with respect to what is the difference between use of strong executive authorities and abuse of them. And some seem to say, so for example, if they make the argument that the president can't obstruct justice or he can't violate the law, that's nonsense. Of course he can if he actually takes those kinds of acts. And it's the same way with respect to abuse of authority. There is an appropriate or a lawful use of constitutional authority, and right, then there's something that abuses it. And directing an attorney general to open an investigation, for example, on a political opponent or on a commentator who he doesn't like what they say, that's an abuse of authority. The remedy for it is a political remedy, which is impeachment. But that doesn't make it less of an abuse of the authority.
No, I agree with you completely. But when you get to the remedy, there is no other remedy other than so that if, in fact, an executive does have a compliant Congress who will not exercise that authority, there is no practical remedy for a president who does that. That's my concern.
Well, this is the way that the constitutional system was designed. And I mean, I think that's why we're so curious to see what the outcome of the obstruction investigation is. If the president fired the FBI director to shut down an investigation, or because he thought that by firing the chief investigator that would shut down an investigation, that's obstruction. And that will have to be referred to Congress.
Yeah, no, I said that is the thing. And that's also why this the responsibility of Congress is so heavy here, no matter whether you're the member of the president's party or not. So is there anything else about the Mueller investigation you want to talk about at this point? Do you, Do you think it's coming down in the next week or so, 2 weeks, month? Want to engage in that kind of?
I am reluctant to put a time frame on it. It does, with the departures of some key personnel, it does seem like at least part of the investigative side of things are coming to an end. Whether that means that they still have more writing to do or unsealing of indictments. And then I think there will be, you know, we don't know. And then I think that there will be some time lag in between the time that the special counsel determines that his work is done and the attorney general is going to need to take some time with it to determine how to report to Congress and what to report or refer to Congress.
So does, one more question. So does Congress have the ability to subpoena information in that report or elements of that report that the attorney general decides not to release? Let's say that the William Barr decides to sit on a big chunk of it. Can Adam Schiff go around him and force the release of that through subpoenas?
I think that as a matter of practice is probably what will happen. And so I think there will be a committee, whether it's, I don't necessarily think the House Intelligence Committee is the right place for that to take place. Probably the Oversight Committee or the Judiciary Committee would be the more appropriate venue. I think they probably will, just as a practical matter, issue a subpoena for underlying information. And then the department and Congress will either have to negotiate that down or they'll litigate parts of it. I think it will be a process in terms of requesting specific information, and I expect that there will be sort of a very substantial process that will have to go back and forth between them, some portion of which might end up in litigation.
Carrie Cordero, thank you so much for talking with us today. I appreciate it very, very much.
Thanks, Charlie. Great to be with you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.